Every great endeavor starts with a vision and a purpose that withstands the test of time. Over 10 years ago, the Institute for Creation Research had a vision. Imagine a world-class destination where generations of young people flock to see with their own eyes scientific evidence that confirms the Bible. That vision is now becoming a reality. Like the Bible itself, the source of truth for over two millennia, the Discovery Center for Science and Earth History will be a beacon of truth about the origin of our Earth, our universe, and ourselves.
What you believe about creation determines what you ultimately believe about salvation. And this is why this Discovery Center is so important.
The overwhelming majority of our young people today have absolutely no idea that the true facts of science support the biblical message better than any other science lab in the country. One of the great things we have at the Institute for Creation Research is the opportunity to put that on display now with this world-class ICR Discovery Center for Science and Earth History.
This Discovery Center is different from other Discovery Centers and museums. This is a place that you can bring your children to see how science confirms what the Bible teaches. They're going to come here, and the parents will know that their kids are going to be getting solid, foundational truth.
We're very excited about this Discovery Center and some of the technology we have planned. We have interactive kiosks where you can learn about topics in more depth. We have a 3D immersive planetarium where you can go see the rings of Saturn up close, or you can take a virtual helicopter tour of the Grand Canyon or Mount St. Helens. We have an Ice Age theater with the air conditioning turned down so that you can see these movies about the Ice Age and how the Bible explains it.
We're going to have a section of the Ark that you can actually walk inside, and animatronic, moving, very realistic. I think the visitor is going to just be overwhelmed with the quality of the work and the quality of the dinosaurs, quality animals that are in that room.
So as we learn more, as new science comes in, we, using the technologies that are in this Discovery Center, can put that on display quickly.
Great progress is being made toward realizing this vision. With your financial support, the Discovery Center for Science and Earth History will soon be a reality. We can start proclaiming the biblical account of creation for all to see.
It seems like there are only two axioms in building a major construction project. One is that it takes longer, and the other is that it costs more. We've spent about $20 million over the last 5 years getting this Discovery Center to this point. We're closing in on the home stretch now, but we still need about $8 million to complete it. We need your help.
We are so close to the goal that God has set in place for us, but we need your help to help put us over the finish line. What will you give to leave a legacy that will influence future generations for Christ? What will you give to make the truth of God's creation known to all?
Invest now in the work of the kingdom, in the souls of men, for the work of eternity.
You can see it's a battle for people's minds. It always has been a battle for people's minds and what people are going to believe and how they are going to frame the data. How many of you were quite astounded when you saw that soft dinosaur tissue and you saw it stretch and you saw it snap back? And that's just a picture of it. And Dr. Clary presented all of that. You saw blood vessels with red blood cells in them. Do you realize there is not... there's not a scientific paper, there's not a scientific study anywhere on the planet, nowhere on the planet, which can explain how tissue can last that long. In fact, there are multiple studies based on current rates of degradation that we see things degrade under the best conditions that when they extrapolate out can't get it to last more than several thousands of years, and when it's preserved at really, really, really cold temperatures, maybe 100,000 years. There are multiple studies which would not support that. So the question is, how many of you are quite amazed that people would still persist almost pigheadedly to believe that these things are 60, 80, 100, 190 million years old? It's quite astounding. It's quite astounding. And that's because your worldview, the way you see things, it permeates the way you think. And I'm here to say that probably some of us in this room have been permeated with evolutionary thinking. And we even hold to evolutionary views. And if I were to say to you, how many of you believe in evolutionary views? You probably very few of you would raise your hand. And yet all of us have had our thinking evolutionized to one extent or the other. So tonight's talk is actually, you can see it up there. It's like a whiteboard talk. And it's going to push back on some evolutionary thinking which has encroached even into Christians and creationist thinking. And hopefully will change the way you see things in the future. I had to do a debate, as Chaz mentioned, several months ago. It was back in January, in fact, in El Segundo. And I had multiple partners, and we had to answer three questions. And actually, the third question, as we have it look on this debate here, was this, that all of us were supposed to answer. Are you open to the natural world pointing to design? Are you open to the natural world pointing to design? And my position was, of course, yes. Yes. So if I were to ask you, and I rarely ever do this in a talk, raise your hand. How many of you think that organisms really were designed? Raise your hand. See, look at that. How many of you can explain to your friends how organisms were designed? How many of you can explain what design looks like? How many of you can explain design when you see it? Good. Look at these young geniuses in the front on that. That's what we want, you know. But the poor people with a little more experience say, I don't know whether I can do that or not. Now, all living things do four things. All living things grow. All living things reproduce. All living things metabolize. It means they're taking resources and turn them into energy. And all living things adapt. Adapt. You know what that means to adapt? It means to be able to self-adjust. If you're taking notes, write this down. All living things self-adjust to changes in their environment to solve environmental problems. That's what living things do. Do man-made things adapt? Of course they do. Human-made things adapt all the time. Now, which is harder to build? An adaptable machine, an autonomous adaptable machine that can adapt to a changing environment, or this pulpit? Obviously, the adaptable machine. Which one gives the designer far more glory? Building a pulpit or designing an autonomous thing that can self-adjust automatically to changes in its environment? It's the second. And that's why the Lord gets his glory by building creatures that right from the very beginning of creation, right from the very beginning, are able to self-adjust to changes in their environment. Now, if organisms could not do that, if organisms were as static as this pulpit right here and they could not adjust, could you get a theory of evolution going? The answer is no. No. It's because organisms can adjust. It's because organisms can change. It's because organisms can adapt that you can get a theory of evolution going. If they were static, you could never, ever do it. So of the four things that organisms do, they grow, they reproduce, they metabolize, and they adapt, which one of those is the most important in regards to creation and evolution? Adaptability. It's adaptability. And reproduction is right on the heels. Because if organisms could not reproduce, could you get a theory of evolution going? No. So two things that organisms do, the fact that they can reproduce and the fact that they can adapt, are very, very important. And there are two diametrically opposed mechanisms for explaining how organisms adapt. In other words, what I mean is this. You have an organism with this number of traits at time zero. The environment changes, and sometimes later it expresses different traits which are suitable for the change in the environment. How does that happen? Well, there are two different explanations. The one is the evolutionary explanation, which is common, and which probably many of you in this room still accept in some form or another. And that is that you get a little bit of genetic variability. Maybe God created the variability, or maybe the variability happened through a genetic mutation. Whatever it is, you got some genetic variability which enables you to express a different type of trait. And then the environment changes, and those that have suitable traits to solve the change, they what? They survive. And those that don't have the suitable traits, they die. And if you don't die, then your genes continue in the trait in the gene pool, and nothing could ever change. And over time, because those that are able to survive and those that are able to change, the organisms are changed over time, and they're molded and shaped by their environment, by the vicissitudes of nature, and all in a very random, undesigned process where you get genetic mutations by chance. Those that live and die are mainly chance-driven, and you have a chance-driven, death-driven worldview. And I suspect many of you hold to that in this room right now. And that worldview, which was popularized by Darwin, is fundamentally, at its very core, naturalistic, which begins with nature creating itself, nature forming itself, nature starting life, and nature shaping and molding the diversity of life on Earth. And it is an anti-design, fully naturalistic explanation for the diversity of life on Earth. And we would expect it to operate in certain ways. Another explanation is a design-based explanation. And it says this, as if I designed organisms. Organisms have sensors, and they're able to detect the way they change when environments change. And when the environment changes, they detect the changes. They send signals inward to logic that says, if the environment does this, then I want you to do that. And they have the ability to express the traits themselves to self-adjust over time so that they solve the environmental problems. And they are able to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. That is a design-based explanation. That is new. Nobody is teaching it. Creationists aren't teaching it. Creationists are teaching you a lighter version of what I told you at the beginning, that you kind of like live and die and the survivors go on and all that kind of stuff. That's what evolutionists teach. That's what creationists have been teaching, just a lighter, softer version of it. They say, well, it works like that. It just can't do everything that evolutionists say. And I'm here to say both of those are wrong. We need to hold to a design-based explanation where organisms were designed from the beginning to detect the changes in their environment and, just like any design thing, self-adjust over time so that they take on the problems. And the first thing I want you to know at the end of this talk, I want you to understand and view creatures and how they adapt fundamentally, totally different than when you walked into this room tonight. I want you not to see them as what they are commonly portrayed as passive modeling clay molded and shaped by their environment, shaped over long periods of time, leading to various traits and the diversity of life on Earth. Two, seeing them as active, problem-solving entities that are able to detect their environmental changes, express suitable traits, solve all those changes, and fill the earth as it changes over time. What I want you to see different Repeat it again because this is really important. I want you not to see them as passive modeling clay molded and shaped by their environment, but I want you to see them as active, problem-solving entities that take on the environmental changes, enabling them to what? Fill the earth. I want you to feel at the end of this talk a lot more awe and admiration and respect for the great designer of those creatures, which is the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to be able to explain this to your friends in a completely different way. So, in answer to that question, are you open to the natural world pointing to it? Yes. Yes. And it says that the workmanship that you see in living things is best explained by intelligent design. Now, what's the key word in the answer? The key word in the answer is? The key word in the answer is, okay, here's a clue. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. His handiwork. And then in Romans chapter 1, it says, for the invisible things of God are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. And the Greek word for made is used only one other time in the New Testament, in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, where it says, we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus. Now, this is really important. So this is already new. This is new things for you as Christians, new things for you as creationists. When you look at this clicker in my hand, does it show evidences of workmanship? Yes, it does. You see workmanship, you notice it when you see it, but what are you seeing in the clicker in my hand? Or when you look at this pulpit, what are you seeing that gives you evidences of workmanship? See, this is hard to explain. What you see on this clicker is you see multiple parts working together for a purpose. Multiple parts working together for a purpose. And you subconsciously pick it up. You see it. You see this, but you don't understand. And you know it's been worked on. You know it's been made. But how do you know it's been made? Because it has multiple parts working together for a purpose. And how many of you have ever seen multiple parts working together for a purpose come together without a workman doing it? Never. You've never seen it. Every time you have seen multiple parts working together for a purpose, it always has a workman. And so what you see here is workmanship. Now, when you look at me, do you see multiple parts working together in a phenomenally cool way for a purpose? I mean, do you? Of course you see that. You instinctively see on me multiple parts working together for a purpose. And you know what? If you could get all the way down to the microscopic level, the molecular level, the level of the molecules, do you know what you would see? Repeat it back. Multiple parts working together for a purpose. Therefore, the key word is workmanship. Workmanship. I see workmanship in this. I see workmanship in this. I see a smart designer of this. I see an incredible genius who made this. On that. I mean, that's what I see. That's what I see. That's what I want you to know. That's what I want you to feel. So we're just going to look at this whole realm of adaptability. Look at those fish up there. You see one with eyes. You see one that's blind. The ones that are blind live in a cave. The question is, how might creatures adapt to a really fast, intense environmental change? How do they go from having eyes and a lot of pigment on their skin to having no eyes and very little pigment on their skin? Well, creatures use, keyword if you're taking notes, innate, meaning internal systems that enable them to produce those traits. This is the key word. This is the key thought. The cave did not cause the traits. The cave did not cause the traits. Most of you are in this room, come into the room thinking they get into the cave works on them, the cave does this, the cave causes the traits over time. Cave environments. Evolutionists think like that. Darwin thought like that. When Darwin saw creatures, he saw a changed environment. He saw a trait that fit the environment. He said, this caused this. Wrong. Totally wrong. The environment just is. The organism adjusts itself to these traits. So I'm giving you a change in causality. Key point number two. Environments don't cause the changes. Some of you are like, wow, I can't believe that because I think environments change me. No, they don't. Everything changes itself. Everything changes itself. So these are important things. And when they do this, and this is what we're finding in science, we're finding characteristics of how organisms change, which don't fit the random mutation, random survival, random death, random non-designed worldview. We are finding characteristics which are using words which fit design. So when organisms change, and this is what we're seeing in the latest findings, they do it by mechanisms that are highly, keyword up there, regulated. Organisms are doing it very rapidly. Organisms do it with mechanisms that lead to repeatable results over and over and over again. We're seeing organisms that can do it with sometimes mechanisms that are reversible. In other words, they can change this way and then they can change back. And we see them produce traits that are highly targeted solutions to very specific problems. Now, when I give you those words, regulated, rapid, repeatable, reversible, or targeted, are you thinking something that's happening randomly or something that's happening purposefully that was designed? Purposefully. So what are the key words? Regulated, rapid, repeatable, sometimes reversible, with what kind of results? Targeted, highly specific results. So all of this is new, and I'm going to take on some icons of evolution. The first one is these cave fish. Now, what you see up on the screen are multiple different types of cave fish, not just the ones there. Over 120 different types of fish, when they get into a cave environment, lose their eyes and lose their pigment, and they change. And you see them go on the top with the sided ones to the unsided ones. They completely change their form when they do this. How in the world do they do it, and how fast do they do it? Well, research shows that it doesn't take long, long periods of time where eyes become a hazard and they get bumped and scratched inside the cave environment. And some of them live and some of them die in a death-driven worldview. In fact, this paper came out in 2013, which shows that these fish are able to detect the cave water. Not the darkness. They're able to actually detect how much water, how much electricity the water can conduct, the conductivity of the water. They detect when they're in the cave, and as mama fish lays her little eggs and they start to develop in the water, they're able to detect that, and in one generation, they go from having eyes to no eyes, and they lose their pigmentation. And parts of their skull that their eyes used to fill in are other parts of their brain are expanding them, giving them heightened sensations for sense of smell and touch and other things like that in one generation. Now, I should hear from the crowd, which I heard from some people, wow, that's pretty impressive. Thank you. That's okay. All right. That is impressive. Okay, little echo. Chamber there. Okay, Mom, don't be that embarrassed. That's okay. There. It's impressive. It's an impressive system. When you think of that, you should be thinking, wow, not again. This is the anti-design. This is the anti-evolution explanation. Okay, here's another icon. Whose finches are these? Darwin's finches. What's the story you're told about how they get big beaks and small beaks? You're told that, you know, you get a big beak when you have these conditions where you get these really, really hard seeds. And the big beak is able to do what? Crush the hard seeds. And what happens to the birds with really small beaks? They what? Die. They die. And then when the environment changes and you get rainy seasons where you get really, really small seeds inside things where you need a really slender beak, they're able to eat the seeds. And what happens to the birds with the big beaks? They what? They die. And a lot of you believe that. That's called what? Natural selection. But natural selection is just a euphemism for you live, you die. It is a death-driven worldview. What if the birds could detect the seeds and signals could be sent in that as those little baby birds develop in the egg, they could produce a beak that was suitable for the seeds that they were eating? That would be a really, really cool design to let things rapidly adapt. Well, that's what they found. They found different types of populations of finches. Some of them are called rural finches. They're like the native finches. They're living out in the woods eating regular finch food. And then you've got the urban finches. And as people have moved on to the Galapagos Islands, they do what people do. They throw their food out and they have trash. And guess who likes to eat the human food? The animals and the finches. And these finches, within just a few years of eating human food, their beak adjusted for the diet of human food. And when they adjusted like that, there was no change at all in their DNA. It was changes to markers on their DNA, enabling the expression of the genes to be changed. So there was no genetic change at all. It was changes on the markers that allow those beaks to rapidly, rapidly, rapidly fit their environment. I should hear what? Wow. Wow, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. Icon of evolution number 2, taken out by a designed mechanism that is what? Regulated, rapid, repeatable, sometimes reversible, with what kind of solutions? Targeted solutions. That's what we see when we have design things. What about this icon of evolution? The what? The peppered moth. What's the story you were told by creationists and evolutionists over this? This is a great illustration of natural selection, but it's not an illustration of evolution. And we were told, you know, you had these light-colored moths. And then in Britain, when they started burning a bunch of coal and coal dust got all over the city, it turned the trees and the buildings and everything what? Black. What happened to the white moths? They got eaten. And the black moths what? Survived. And they adjusted. What if the moths could detect the changes? What if there was a regulated mechanism that actually led them to change in colors? Well, this paper was published in 2016. And it reports on this. Don't read the slide yet. I'll tell you what happens. In your DNA, everybody thinks your DNA is really static. It isn't. There are sections of DNA, sometimes large sections, that can move around on the chromosomes. It gets cut out of one portion, it moves to another portion, it gets inserted, and it can get out, cut out, and gets inserted. So you have portions of your DNA which can move around on the chromosome, and when it moves around, it changes the expression of those genes. And ahead of every gene, there's a section called a promoter. Well, guess what? A section of this mobile DNA was excised, and it's no small section. It's over 20,000 bases of DNA long. It's excised, and over 95% of the black moths just happen to have that portion of mobile DNA inserted in their promoter, turning them black. And guess how many percentage of the white moths have it inserted? Zero. Zero. So you have a section of mobile DNA for black moths, which predominantly turns them black. And for the white moths, zero. Does that sound like a highly regulated mechanism, even controlling the location of mobile DNA? Yes, it is. And Shapiro there in the paper with the blue title epigenetic controls. Those are the controls where I told you it doesn't change the DNA. It's changing the regulation of the DNA, but not changing the DNA itself. Epigenetic controls of mobile DNA as an interface between experience and genome change. Wow, that's kind of cool. It's saying that this mobile DNA is an interface linking you to your what? Experiences. And not only does it link you to your experiences, you can pass those on to your offspring, and it can link your offspring to your experiences. Wow, that's kind of cool. It wasn't this random, goofy survival of the fittest kind of explanation. It was a mechanism that was what? Regulated, rapid, repeatable, and reversible. You say, some of you are like, wow, this is Sunday night, 8 p.m., and you're forcing me to learn stuff? It's not Sunday school, because that happens in the mornings on that. And you're forcing me to remember four R's? Well, of course I'm forcing you to remember four R's, because I want you to walk out of here what? Fundamentally changed. Fundamentally changed on how we see this. So, let me give you another couple cool examples. You guys don't ice fish down here, but where I went to medical school at the University of Minnesota, everybody loves to ice fish. I never could see the wisdom in it, personally. But they would say, hey, come on, doc, come out and ice fish with us. Well, anyway, when they go ice fishing in these frozen lakes, there's that big fish on the left over here. What's that called? That is a pike. It's a muskie, a northern pike. Same thing. They're all in the same family. And they're a predator fish. And they'll eat trout, and they'll eat carp, and they'll eat bass, and all those kinds of things. This is a picture of a carp. As long as that muskie or that northern is eating a trout, or it's eating a bass, that carp looks like that. But as soon as that pike eats one of these carps, brings it in, digests it through its system, and excretes into the lake water digested carpy stuff. The other carp have a sensor for that digested carpy stuff, and within one day, their shape will change to that, making them harder to be eaten by the pike. One day, they change that when they detect the digested carpy stuff. In fact, you can take some of the skin from one of these carps, skin them, put it in a blender, blend it all up, put it in a fish tank with the other carp. They detect it, and they morph into that other change in one day. Is that regulated, rapid, repeatable? Yes. That's a wow. Yeah, that's like a big wow. How about this one? This is another fish. This is called a reef race. This lives down on the reefs. This is a male, this brightly colored male. And this over here, this yellow one, is a female. Usually there's one male with about a harem of about 10 to 15 females. One male covers all of those females on that. What happens if a fisherman comes by and snags that male and fishes it out of the harem? So now you have a harem of females but no male. What's a lonely female to do on that? What in the world is going to happen there? Well, within one day, one of those females will detect that the male is gone. Her ovaries will regress. She will grow testes, and she will morph into a colorful male within one day and replace the male in that harem. Wow. Wow. I mean, the ability to morph into a male, isn't that what every woman has really wanted to do? I mean, for a long, long time? I mean, we have all the advantages and stuff, so you would think that would be like a wonderful trait. Anyway, regulated? Yes. Rapid? Repeatable? Yes. Reversible? I don't know. But does it have a really highly targeted result? Yes. Here's another fish. This guy lives down in Mexico, and it lives in streams, this particular one, that has been polluted with hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is a gas that kind of smells like rotten eggs, sulfury smell. But it's usually toxic. But this fish is living in it. Guess what? In its gills, it's got sensors. Sensors for all kinds of stuff. And one of the sensors happens to be for what? Hydrogen sulfide. And when it detects the hydrogen sulfide, it doesn't just change a gene. And everybody thinks, you got the gene for this, you got the gene for this, you got the gene for good looks, you got the gene. No. Most of your traits are controlled by many, many, many genes. And look what it says on the slide. When it detects the hydrogen sulfide, it upregulates 1,600 genes and downregulates 1,800 genes. And when it changes those genes, the traits for how it absorbs hydrogen sulfide changes, how it excretes hydrogen sulfide changes, and how it metabolizes hydrogen sulfide changes. So now it can live and it can fill a stream with what? Hydrogen sulfide. Regulated, rapid, repeatable, with a very, very targeted result. Very, very targeted result. And this is what we see over and over again. And it can be passed on from generation to generation. Look at this headline. What does it say? Mice can warn sons of dangers via sperm. Now, that's kind of a truncated story of what really happened. This is what happened. You take a bunch of male mice and you put them on a metal pad that has electrodes on it that can shock their feet painfully. I don't do this. Evolutionary biologists do this kind of stuff. And you... So you got these male mice on this pad where they get painful shocks. But they don't just shock them indiscriminately. They expose them to cherry blossom odor. And when they're exposed to cherry blossom odor, they get a shock. Expose, shock. Expose, shock. Shock, 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 shock. On that. Then you take these male mice, which have been treated like this, and you mate them with a naive female. What's a naive female? Not the type that human males are looking for. But a naive female is one that has never been exposed to cherry blossom odor ever. They mate. She has pups. You sacrifice the pups instantly upon birth. Bad. And you dissect them through their olfactory region up here. And you stain it for the nerves and the bulbs for cherry blossom odor in these pups. And these are the controls. These are the bulbs. These are the nerves running back from their nose of the controls. And look at the offspring that have never been exposed to cherry blossom odor. Over a 200% increase in the bulbs and the nerves specifically for what? Cherry blossom odor. And the DNA of dad was never changed. Mom's DNA never changed. It was changes to the regulation by markers on the DNA, which exchanges the expression of that DNA while those pups are in development inside a mom's womb, of the mouse womb, and they're developing, that makes them ready for cherry blossom odor. But it may have been fox urine. It might have been something else. Now that's kind of cool. Rapid, repeatable, highly targeted result of how organisms change. Now, how in the world are they doing it? They're doing it, believe it or not, by the exact same mechanisms and the exact same engineering principles. So if you're taking notes, same what? Mechanisms. Same engineering principles, which explain how man-made things self-adjust to changes. Now, you see there up on the screen a picture of what? A cruise control. How many of you use cruise control? All of you. Is it a self-adjusting mechanism? Yes, it is. How does it work? Someone came up to you and they said, how do you think cruise control works? Would you go, I don't know. Well, don't do that. Don't do that. You're not engineers. Many of you aren't. But you can explain it. You can explain it. The purpose of cruise control is to keep you at a steady what? Speed. So you must, if you want to know what speed you're at, you would have to have a speed what? Sensor. A speed detector. You'd have to have a know. Does everybody see that? You'd have to have some kind of way to know what your speed is. So you need a speed sensor. And then, what else do you need to have? You need to have some kind of computer that says, if I start to slow down, then what? Send a signal to my throttle to what? Speed up. Speed it up. So you have a sensor, you have a logic mechanism, and you have an output. And you guys aren't even engineers, and you figured that out. You have a what? A sensor, a logic mechanism, and an output. Well, what do you think organisms have if they're going to rapidly adjust to changes too? They must have a what? Sensor, logic, and an output. And they do it exactly like that. They have all of those things. And this is what's cool. As engineers build things like a space shuttle, which are going to go through all these different kinds of environments, the engineers think in advance. They think in advance of all of the challenges that that space shuttle is going to face. And they build into, the space shuttle all of the solutions to the potential problems. They build them in advance. Can engineers wait for the environment to give the space shuttle a solution to a problem? No. Impossible. Impossible. Won't happen. Can't ever happen. Therefore, engineers build into design things solutions which precede the challenges. Does that make sense? This is really important because evolutionists are going to tell you the solutions are due to the challenges. Solutions are due to the challenges. But design is the exact opposite. It says you have to have the solutions before you face the challenges. And they're built in. So all of those things that I told you about, the fish that change, the dads that can pass on the traits to change to their offspring, and all of those things, the solutions were there what? Before they ever had the challenges. Now this is really important. This is really important. Solutions precede the challenges. They are not due to the challenges. And so this fits exactly with what we see in Romans chapter 1, where we see evidences of what? Workmanship or handiwork, where the solutions precede the challenges by highly regulated mechanisms. Highly, highly regulated mechanisms. So if what I'm saying is true, can I make some predictions? If this has any scientific validity whatsoever, I should be able to predict some things and see if they come to pass. Well, there's actually several things I could predict. One, creatures. This is a good prediction. This would be one where someone could prove that a random mechanism was really at work. I'm saying that creatures are going to self-adjust to changing conditions by the same engineering principles that are going to explain how man-made things self-adjust. So that would be easy to prove. All you'd have to do is come up with some creature that is adapting over time that isn't operating by design principles. And there's none. There's none. And then second, this is really important. Discoveries will continue to show. I should probably put the word continue. Discoveries will continue to show that not 99%, but 100% of adaptive capacity is in the organism. Is in the organism. And this is important because most of the time, evolutionists and even creationists think, well, the environment is kind of shaping them. Or the environment causes these things to change. Or maybe, I had some evolutionists say this, the environment is sending messages, instructions to these organisms, and the environment is instructing them how to change. There's a whole book, textbook that's written on that, that the environment is sending instructions to the organisms. Is any of that true? No. How in the world does the environment send you instructions? How do you detect when the environment is sending you instructions? It isn't sending you instructions. This is how it works. When the Lord designed you, and the Lord designed all of the creatures, and he wanted those things to change, or he wanted them to respond to something in the environment, one, he specifies what the condition will be. What the condition will be. Two, he gives you a sensor or a detector for it. Three, he gives you logic to handle it. He specifies all of those things. So, I'm communicating to you. I'm communicating information to you. The information starts in my brain and it ends up in your brain. How in the world does that happen? Does it happen by magic? No. No magic. It's totally designed. Let's take it from the top. An incredible, deep, profound thought starts in my brain, which is all that I ever have. And so I have this thought. It starts in my brain. And then what do? I code it. I code it into language. And then nerves, after it's coded into language, go to my vocal cords. And I then do what? What do my vocal cords do? They compress the air. They compress the air. And I am sending to you, actually from these speakers, compressed air. Okay, now you pick it up. What detects the compressed air? Your what? Your ears, but more specifically, your ear what? Drums. They detect the vibrations. They send electrical signal to your brain. What does your brain do? It decodes my message. It decodes my message because we're speaking a common language. And it takes it takes vibrating air, and suddenly it's decoded into language, and bang, it ends up as information in your brain. Wow, that's kind of cool. And it all happens through engineering principles, which are highly explainable, which things happen. Now, I generally send you these messages by compressed air. I'm not sending you messages by flashing light, though I could, or I could send you messages by hand signals, though I could, but your eardrums are never going to pick up what? Hand signals or flashing light. That's because the designer specified compressed air to be the condition. And he gave you a detector for compressed air for that condition. So engineers specify the condition and they give you a detector. Are you following along with all this? That's how it works. That's how it works. And he will, if he wants you to be able to detect light, he will give you a sensor for light. If he wants you to be able to detect temperature, he'll give you a sensor for detection for that. If he wants me to be able to stand upright like this without falling over, he gives me sensors for that. And that's how all of this works. And that's how organisms adapt. So here is the bright idea. When organisms do this, they have sensors to detect and systems that track changing environments over time. And they do it through mechanisms that are anything but random and anything but death driven. He gives them mechanisms which have all of the characteristics of being designed, and that those mechanisms operate by what characteristics? They are rapid, repeatable, regulated, reversible. I messed you up because you thought I was going to start with what? Regulated on that. I'm just seeing if you're hanging with me. The characteristics. Characteristics that fit design systems are what? Regulated, rapid, repeatable, sometimes reversible, but with what kind of results? Targeted solutions. That's how engineers work. That's how engineers design things. That's how organisms really are adapting. And organisms, therefore, to the glory of the Lord, are these what? Active, problem-solving entities which take on the environmental challenges. They solve them giving the ability to be what? Fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And that's how adaptation really happens. New thoughts altogether. New thoughts that really glorify the Lord. New thoughts that give him much, much more glory, much, much more honor than some death-driven worldview, some death-driven explanation, which is fed by random mutations. We now have a better way of understanding how organisms adapt, and hopefully, you can explain that to your friends on those things. If you want, there's that one of the DVDs out there, actually goes into, it's one of the talks, I think it's the one that says four biological facts you need to know. The third biological facts in Amarillo, I explained in great depth why this selectionist, natural selectionist worldview is just a misleading mental construct that was invented by Darwin and has no basis in reality. None. And that would help you understand that. And then one of the books out there, I believe it's called Clearly Seen, has how to explain design to your friends so that you can pick up stuff like this and explain how organisms adapt. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for hanging in there for Sunday school class at 8 o'clock at night. And I'll turn it back over to the pastor. There he is. Thank you. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and thank Chaz Morse for bringing his friends, Dr. Clary and Dr. DeLisa. And I want you to know, Dr. Galuza, this is not a static pulpit. Its designer, Ken Evans, has engineered into it adaptability. And since I'm shorter than you are, and I'm a changing environment, this pulpit is designed to suit that need by design. So thank you, Ken, for that. Just a couple of things as we close our evening together. Hopefully this is a foretaste of something to come in the next year. We're in the planning stages of a bigger, larger conference on these things. So hopefully you'll be hearing more about that. Also, we need some volunteers this evening to help move some chairs around and set up some tables for a planning meeting tomorrow about that very thing. So if you're able to stick around for a few minutes and you have some muscles, we could use you on this side of the room. And then lastly, if you have questions about the state of your own soul, if you're curious about how you can know your Creator personally through Jesus Christ, I want you to come talk to me. A couple of our pastors here at Grace Bible Church will be up here. If you have something you would love to be prayed for about, or if you would like to be introduced personally to the Creator of the universe, we would love to be able to do that. So with that, I'll pray and we'll be dismissed. God, we thank you for your grace, your kindness, for the truth of your word, which never fails, though assaulted much by the worldviews, by the ideas of man, it will never falter. And it will always agree with truth. As the grass withers, the flower fades, but your word stands forever. We thank you for these things, that we can base our faith on that which is reliable and true and trustworthy, on you. And we thank you for all these things and for this evening in Jesus' name. Amen.